KLYT Broadcast Studio. This is ABQ Connect.
Peter Martin is the teaching pastor with Calvary Marana in Tucson, Arizona. He's the author of Rooted in Sin, Rescued by Love, and the Fellowship of Suffering. His books teach about Christianity, sexuality, trauma, and hope. This is going to be an interview that you might want to temper if you have young ears listening a little bit, and pretty serious stuff. But Pastor Peter, I am so appreciative of you joining us, and I know there's so many people that are fighting different things with trauma. They need hope in the face of that, and a lot of sexuality and maybe even sexual addiction out there. So thanks for joining us and talking to us about this today.
No problem. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Jim.
Hey, I want to start off with Calvary Marana in Tucson, Arizona, or just outside. Tell us a little bit about your church.
That's right. Yeah, we started about 2 years ago. So it was September of 2023. We were sent out from my home church of Calvary Christian Fellowship in Tucson, Arizona. And the way that Tucson's oriented, kind of like a lot of cities, is you have suburb areas on the outskirts, and Marana is kind of in the northwest part of Tucson, just as you're exiting out. It's a kind of a farming community, but it is now an up-and-coming suburb community from a lot of transplants from bigger cities like in Oregon or California. So a lot of young families and things like that. We're meeting out of a elementary school right now, Glen Farms Elementary, but it's been going pretty well. Pretty awesome, to be honest.
So you kind of have a portable kit, and you got a team that's setting you up and taking you down, huh?
That's exactly correct. Yeah.
Well, I appreciate that very much, because Calvary Albuquerque, which you're familiar with, our radio station's located on their campus. But when we first bought the old indoor tennis club of Albuquerque, we used to go over to a little supplier that had staging and stuff. And so every Friday, me and three other guys, we'd go pick up this staging, unfold everything, set up a platform that was about 4 feet high, hang a curtain around it, put up a pulpit. And we did that for a long time. And I will say this, I smile because we began to feel that was hard work, but we began to feel that was just part of the worship, right? Because we were preparing it for people to come, and the more people that would come and have just an amazing time of fellowship and worship, we could look at their faces and just know this is exactly what we should be doing. So I know the people that are helping you set up at the elementary school are really blessed to do that. That's a neat thing. Love it.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of interesting, you know, in the old covenant, they had the tabernacle, which was like a tent setup. Mm-hmm. And the priests were the ones who carried the ornamentations of the tabernacle and were tasked with setting it up. So, you know, it's not too far off to say that that is a religious act, like an act of worship or service in and of itself, to set up the location, to kind of hollow the ground that is going to now be set apart and used for the purposes of drawing near to God. So I it's very cool. And then obviously, you know, as the Israelites get more advanced and they get their own land, then they develop a permanent temple mount. But, and that's what happens with most churches. You get a permanent land that God gives you and ordains for you to worship him on. But before that, yeah, it's a transient lifestyle for sure.
Yeah, Peter, this is not on my little list of things to talk about, but now that you're bringing this up, I think that part of the questions I have a little bit later in our interview today is to talk to you about, you know, being a pastor. And in many cases, obviously, you're not intending this, but people begin to not necessarily worship you, but put you higher and higher on a pedestal. And that's a lot of pressure, isn't it? Are you feeling that?
So I have a very weird personality where innately I think very lowly of myself. So it's when people think highly of me, I think it's kind of a joke. So it doesn't tempt me, I think, in the way that it would for most people, but, I see it tempting my personality in a different direction.
Gotcha.
But yeah, I I could see it being a stumbling block for everybody. I think when we were planting the church, one of the main sections that stood out to me, it's a passage that most people know, but it's in Lord Acton's writings. And he says, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And he's writing this in a letter to one of his friends who's writing a history of the church. And what Lord Acton is showing is he's showing that, number one, power has a corrosive effect on the soul of an individual, because we are tempted to fall into the sin of Lucifer. And that's what Paul warns about in 1 Timothy 3, that we become, instead of becoming someone who points to God, we start to become God in our own minds. And that's a temptation for sure for everybody who has any amount of authority that God has granted to them. But what Lord Acton does is he separates types of power. He says that there's what we would call like celebrity power, which is that you don't have any actual power itself other than influence and the way that people look at you. And then there's what you call like political power, which means that you have the ability to effectuate like legislative change in a particular community, but you're not necessarily a celebrity. And what he says in the passage is that most of the time, these two types of power are separated, right? So the people who are celebrities rarely have political power, and the people who have political power are rarely celebrities. And he said that church pastors are unique in that the two are put together, that you have almost a celebrity status because people know you in kind of like a stage setting where you get up and you teach a sermon and you have like a persona. But then you also have political power where you can actually legislate change within the community that you're a leader within. So he says that church leadership is actually the most dangerous form to have. And it's the easiest to corrupt your character and soul. So I definitely took that very seriously. Starting the church, I put a lot of checks and balances into the structure and edifice of our church community. But it is a tempting thing for various reasons, for sure.
Well, we've already blown by our first segment, so I'm going to have to take a break and say thank you to our sponsors. But we're going to spend our other three segments, and we're going to have you all the way up until 2 o'clock. We're going to talk more about this and the accountability you've set up. I want to hear about you. I know that part of your history was when you were around 15, 16 years old, you decided that you weren't a believer anymore. And that's even awkward for me to say to you, because I know your dad and mom and have known them for a really long time. So I'm sure that was a tough thing. So when we come back, we're talking with Pastor Peter Martin. He is the teaching pastor with Calvary Marana in Tucson, Arizona, former United States Marine. Thank you so much for your service. He has a life story that I think everybody that's listening today will be very encouraged by. And by the way, wives, you're going to be encouraged to hear about Peter, his walk, his battle with pornography, his wife's actions in the midst of that. I think your wife's a rock star, although I haven't had the pleasure of meeting her. So more with Pastor Peter Martin right after these messages.
On KLYT, this is ABQ Connect.
We're back on ABQ Connect. Thank you so much for joining us today. I think all of our listeners, if you just joined us, you're going to just love hearing from Peter Martin. He's talked to us about sexuality, trauma, hope in the midst of difficulties in those areas. He is a scholar, loves to study, and it's a pleasure to have you on. Would you tell us, Peter, a little bit about your upbringing? You know, your dad was very involved in Christian radio his entire career. I met him a little bit before. I think he was even a believer, and then he took over KKIM radio in Albuquerque many years ago. And I know that eventually led to him moving out into the area where you live now and owning multiple radio stations out there. Talk to us about how you were raised and where and what you were doing when you were 15, 16 years old.
Yeah. So, as you said, Jim, both my parents are solid believers, especially by the time I came around. So I'm the youngest in the family. And at that point, when I was born, my parents were fairly well established in the community that we're part of in Tucson, Arizona. My dad was general manager of a Christian radio station. He was leading worship in a church out here at Calvary Tucson with Robert Furrow. My mom has always been very involved in the church community. And so, yeah, I was raised in a very solid Bible-believing Christian home. I was raised with excellent values and morals and always taught right things by my parents, not just from what they said, but also their actions and behaviors behind closed doors. I very much look up to my parents, always have and always will. It was around my early teenage years, though, that I started struggling pretty intently with pornography and sexual sin. And it was hard for me to reconcile what I was doing with my Christian faith. And so slowly but surely, I started to doubt the existence of God, not really because it was something that I believed, but it was something that I more or less wanted to believe. I didn't really want there to be a God out there that was judging my behavior and finding my character wanting. So I moved away from God, but it was more of a subtle move. It was something that my family was probably not aware of. It was something that I was more open about at school. I went to public school, but I wasn't really open about it at home. And it took a couple years to come back to my faith. I was, I think, 16 or 17 years old when I came back to my faith. And still had a very rocky relationship with God over the next decade, though, really trying to work through these issues, the issues of sexuality and pornography.
Well, as you're talking, I'm thinking in those days, there wasn't, you know, social media and all of the things to the extent that there are now. When I was that age, there was none of that. There weren't even cell phones.
Right.
So I'm thinking right now, I mean, you're a parent. How do you feel about kids today and this, how easy it is to access all of these things that distracted you at this time?
Yeah, no, the accessibility of pornographic material is just incredibly daunting in the modern day. It's everywhere. Even if you wanted to go the Amish route as a parent and just say hey, I'm not going to introduce my kid to technology or anything like this. I think the social psychologist Jonathan Haidt, he wrote a book called The Anxious Generation, which is a really good read for just a modern parent trying to navigate the digital landscape. And his argument is that the problem is kind of a collective action one, meaning that even if I prevent my child from accessing that material, they're in a world that is saturated by it. And so it's going to be very hard to socialize them with other kids that are also making the same decision. So you'd have to kind of go the full Amish route if you wanted to try that, where you really do just move into a small community where everybody is doing the same thing as you are. Barring that, your child will have exposure to these technologies and these technologies that have easy access to sensual and pornographic material that is becoming more and more pervasive. And with the innovation of AI, it's becoming more radical and the morality of it is shifting, I think, all the time. It's a very, very strange issue. It's a very pervasive issue and a very difficult to navigate issue. So I think that we almost have to look at it. You know, I think that for Americans or people in the West predominantly, we've gotten used to having a culture that in most ways reflects our values. And I think we're going to have to get back into the mindset of the early church where you're navigating a pagan world in which the main institutions and places that you go do not reflect your values. And they have not only pagan, but sexual material and pornographic material just on display. I mean, we tend to forget that, like, centers of commerce for the ancient Roman world circled around these pagan temples where there was orgiastic behavior, there were sacrifices being made to pagan gods, there was public nudity, prostitution, things just on display everywhere you would go. And the Christians had to learn how to navigate that landscape. And the way that they did it was by adopting Christ's admonishment to be a city on a hill, right? That they had to have a fellowship and a community of believers that kept them on the straight and narrow and allowed them to follow God in a paganistic world. But I think that that's going to be a very big transition for most people, because most people, like, their lives are not oriented that way. They don't see the church that way, where the majority or bulk of community or life that they experience is outside of the church. The church is a supplement to their relationship with God, in which they engage maybe once a week and probably very superficially with the community that they're a part of. And they just need to realize that in order to have a fellowship with the Lord, in order to actually navigate this increasingly pagan world that we're a part of, you're going to have to see your local church very differently. It's going to have to become that community that not only helps you navigate your own life, but also helps raise your child. Because right now, the institutions that are raising your child are, unfortunately, increasingly antagonistic to your faith and moving them away from the values that you want to instill in your kids.
I want to ask you about your books, Rooted in Sin, Rescued by Love, and The Fellowship of Suffering. These are really structured like workbooks, right? And are they still available for people to buy?
The Rooted in Sin book, I had a copyright problem with it, and I've honestly been too, I could be more complimentary to myself, and I could say I'm too busy, but I'm honestly just too lazy to renew the copyright, and that's a problem for me. I need to get on that. The Fellowship of Suffering book is still in print, though, and can be accessed on Amazon and anywhere else you want to buy books.
So you've mentioned in your history, you know, pornography, maybe even addiction to that was part of your life. And, but you talk about addiction, trauma, you talk about depression, and are kids and their exposure to our culture contributing to trauma and depression in the lives of a lot of people?
I mean, it's a very complex question, because there's a lot of avenues that I could look at and say, yeah, these are contributing factors to how we would look at that stuff. So the first one I would look at I would say that, let's just take the human soul and look at it the way you would look at the human body. So the human body reacts to damage in particular ways, but it also reacts to health in different ways. And the majority of what we're supposed to do to take care of our body is nutritional and not medicinal. So you only go to a doctor when something's wrong. The majority of what you're doing to your body regularly is you're trying to keep it in good form so that you need to go to the doctor less and less, hopefully. The soul works the same way. There are things that you could do medicinally to the soul, right? You undergo a trauma, death in a family, grief, some sort of abuse, something like that, an addiction, then you need medicinal help. You need to go to a church or a counselor or someone who's going to help you work through that particular issue in a way that reorients the soul and gets it back into working condition. But what I would say is most problematic about our culture is that the things that most cultures have seen as the bare minimum of healthy spiritual activity is denied to the bulk of people. So I'll just give you three things so you can help see this. Most people who study like happiness and human flourishing, they would break down human like spiritual health into three different categories. And that would be the feeling of purposefulness or meaningfulness, integration in a larger community, and the feeling of competency. right? Those three things, if you have them, it really doesn't matter what's going on in your life. You can have you can have a level of blessedness or happiness or joy within your individual life. But many of us don't have any of those three things. So if you think about like the first one, which is a feeling of purposefulness or meaningfulness, how many of us genuinely feel meaningful throughout our lives, right? When we're growing up, we go to schools and we don't have much purpose or meaning there because we're just being educated for something higher. Then you get a job and you're in a corporate world in which you're just kind of a number on a spreadsheet. No one really cares about you. And if you left or got fired, they would just replace you like that. Even in your church community, you're maybe pretty anonymous without many people knowing your name or where you're from or what's going on in your life. So you're not very meaningful there. Then you go to integration. It's like, yeah, you have friends, but most of our friendships are superficial nowadays. The bulk of it happening online or in social media spaces. And then you go to the final one, which is competency. It's like, well, if you don't feel integrated and you don't feel meaningful in the things that you're doing, it's very difficult to feel competent. Like you're actually accomplishing something good or well. It's much easier to just think that you're doing very poorly, especially, again, you add social media into the complex and it's like you're now competing on a global scale in whatever you think you're good at and comparing yourself to people around the world at all times. So feeling competent in the modern world is almost a pipe dream. It's almost impossible. So it's like with the three things that would predict human happiness and flourishing, the majority of us don't have them, which means that our souls are just degraded in some sense. They're vulnerable and fragile and open to all sorts of unhealthy patterns, as well as, again, whatever issues might confront us, we don't have resiliency to deal with them. So I think if I had to say, I would say that's probably the biggest issue. But I think there are others integrated in that as well.
So what's the answer to that? I mean, if we identify our friends by how many people are following us online or how many people call us friends on Facebook or Instagram or some of these other platforms, how do you overcome that? How does Peter Martin get people involved in the community of Marana, especially younger people? It's got to start with their parents, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you know, it starts with the parents. It starts in the culture that you develop. But again, very complex question. I'm going to try to answer it as succinctly as I can. But I'll say is that the people that you feel most integrated with are the people that you feel accountable to. Right. So in the military, there are many flaws with the military community, but that was the first community that I actually felt like I belonged. And that sense of belonging did not come from what that community offered me. It was what I was willing to offer to that community. I felt accountable to them. In other words, I really felt the weight that these people, the people that were living with me and serving with me, depended on me. And I needed, like, my actions and behaviors actually mattered to them. And because of that, I couldn't just take off. I couldn't just abandon them. It very much is kind of like the Uriah the Hittite type mentality where it's like, you know, even if the king is calling me to his court, and even if the king is telling me to go relax at home, I can't relax knowing that my brothers in arms are suffering. You know, it's that kind of camaraderie that you develop in the military, and that's what's lacking. So the church, not to sound cheesy or weird, the church is supposed to be the answer to that. So the church is kind of like the anti-Babel. So the world is always trying to build up towers of Babel that are supposed to integrate all of our lives under one banner. And they're always going to be pagan. They're usually going to be the state or some other philosophical system or religious system. And they're always going to fall short. And therefore, they're always going to cause fragmentation, which is the confusion of languages that happens after the Tower of Babel. And it's interesting that when the church is founded, it's an anti-Babel, right? So Babel falls apart when the languages are confused. The church is started when the languages are revealed through the gift of tongues. So the church is that thing that is supposed to integrate all other facets of our life, right? It is the thing that's actually supposed to bring us together, bring us to cohesion and wholeness. I think it's fascinating. I kind of like superhero movies because I'm a bit nerdy in some aspects. I think it's fascinating that, you know, comic books have been around for 100 years. But it's only been the last 20 that they've gained the type of cultural relevance that they have today. It's completely new and unique time to be into material like Marvel Comics or DC Comics. And the reason I believe that it's happening is because what the hero myth shows is this idea of a disintegrated identity. So the hero is a mythological figure that has a dual identity. They have a heroic identity and they have a civilian identity. And these two parts of themselves can't be integrated. They can't be brought together. And so the hero suffers as a result. And in our modern world, I think that's how we all feel. You know, we go to work and we have an identity there. We go home, we have an identity there. We go to church, we have an identity there. And these things aren't integrated in any meaningful way. And so we feel lost and meaningless. The church is supposed to remedy that. You go to one central place where you can be everything that you are and have a kind of community that makes relevant the decisions that you make within the world itself. So say I'm like a cop or something like that, and I go out every day and I risk my life. Well, I'm risking my life for people I don't know, for anonymous strangers. But if I integrate myself in a church community, now I could get to know at an intimate level the kind of people that I'm protecting on a day in, day out basis. And they could get to know me. And now the police force that protects them while they sleep are not just a bunch of nameless, faceless individuals that are just there to die for them no matter what. They're people that they are accountable to. And the police feel accountable to the people that they know individually, right? So it creates this integrated identity that can actually make you have experience wholeness. But that only works if you want to move into your community of church and say, this is a community I want to be accountable to. I want to know these people. I want to know my leadership. I want to live a life of accountability and transparency so that I'm not just a nameless, anonymous face that comes in and out once a week. And that's a hard thing. That's a decision. That's an act of the will to be vulnerable and transparent. And that's a very hard thing to do.
When we come back from this break, I'm going to ask you about whether people see themselves as God sees them. Do they see themselves in a way that God knows? God can use us in any situation, but maybe we don't see ourselves that way. We'll be back with Peter Martin. He's the pastor of Calvary Marana in near Tucson, Arizona. Their website is calvarymarana.com, and really encourage you to go there, and you can click on the teaching tab and you can hear all that Pastor Peter is going over, the complete biography and on he and his wife and his family and all the leadership of their church, teachings again available. So in this hour, we're not going to spend all the detail that we need, but we're going to talk to Pastor Peter as much as we can and get through as much of this material as we can. And I hope as you listen, you'll be encouraged. We'll be back with Peter Martin right after these messages.
On KLYT, this is ABQ Connect.
We're back on ABQ Connect. Pastor Peter Martin is with us. He's the teaching pastor of Calvary Marana, Tucson, Arizona. Pretty new church, a couple years old, and Pastor Peter served for many years at Calvary Christian Fellowship of Tucson. And you were actually sent out by the church, weren't you, to Marana, Pastor?
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I love that because I don't think very many people still see that kind of thing happening. I know there's a lot of these video churches and a lot of different things. And I'm sure that that's all having a positive effect in the body, but I really like the fact that you are there in person and teaching and investing your lives into people. There's a few things that you've told me over some years that we've done interviews, and I want to ask you some things that are going to relate. How does depression, and I think there's a lot of people that don't realize their calling because they don't see themselves the way God does. And I think depression confuses a person's ability to process incoming information. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. So psychology, we differentiate between grief and depression. Well, I would say that psychology used to, right? The counseling ministries, the counseling people, both in the secular and religious spheres, used to understand or differentiate between grief and depression. I don't think they do that too much anymore. And I think that there are negative incentive structures, especially in psychopharmacological drugs, that enable that to happen. I'm not going to get into that right now. Traditionally, the differentiation was that grief was when your external circumstances matched your internal reality. So if my wife died today or one of my children died today, I would exhibit all of the psychological qualities of depression, but a psychologist, a counselor, or even a pastor wouldn't call me depressed because my external realities matched my internal ones. And we see this in the New Testament as well as the Old Testament. When people are going through grievous moments of their life, they're not considered to be disordered. They're considered to be correctly ordered. Even the Apostle Paul says we are sorrowful yet always rejoicing in 2 Corinthians 6. So even though we have this great hope in Christ, we go through externally tragic circumstances that cause sorrow. And that's the right response. The right response to grievous behavior or grievous events is grief. But depression is when there's a mismatch between external circumstances and internal realities. So if there's nothing externally grievous happening to me, yet I'm perceiving my reality through a depressed lens, then there's something disordered about my psyche. And there are numerous, numerous reasons or causes for that to happen. You've mentioned one, Jim, and that is being out of touch with reality as such. So like, I can't remember who it was, but essentially, I think it was Albert Camus when he said that the depression and suicide were the end of philosophy. And what he meant by that is he's like, if you take the atheistic worldview seriously, who wouldn't be depressed, right? So in other words, if you really took it seriously, that we are just matter in motion, there's no real free will, you're just dancing to the tune of your DNA, you're nothing more than a collection of nurture and nature at work within your life, you come from nothing, your life means nothing, and eventually you will go to be with nothing, meaning that nothingness and emptiness is actually your God. That is the atheistic world to do. And yeah, when you play it out like that, it's like, yeah, to be internally in despair about that reality is actually, it actually integrates well with the external reality of the atheist. So the Christian could live like that, though. Even though there is a God, you don't come from nothing. You come from everything. You are made in the image and likeness of the creator of the universe. You have a high and holy calling to glorify him, to be the mediator between nature and spirit for all of eternity, to be so powerful in the plan of creation and redemption that it says in the Bible that even angels long to look into the good things that God is doing in your life and the grace that he has shown you and the reality of redemption that he has accomplished through his son, right? To know that and to believe that is a high and immense calling. And if you're able to accept it, then depression is not the right response to your external circumstances. But actually ingratiating that belief inside of your soul is not an easy one, especially in a society that has become so nihilistic and fruitless. And once again, that comes back to community, surrounding yourself with people that really believe that and are able to speak those words of life and truth into you. That's actually going to really help you with that.
Yeah, I love that. How is secrecy weighing Christians down in their personal lives and their relationships?
Yeah, so it goes back to what I was talking about with superhero movies. So you watch any superhero movie and there's that. I think that the Iron Man 2 movie, which wasn't the best, to be honest, but they did it fairly well, where his superhero identity was actually an analog for addiction. And it clearly is, where mm-hmm. he's putting this thing in his chest that's actually poisoning his heart and killing him. And the idea is pretty simple. It's that he's become addicted to appearing a certain way, as opposed to being that in reality. So his internal personal life is falling apart, but his Iron Man persona is shining brighter and brighter with each passing day. So that's that disintegration that I'm talking about. So you have an external persona that you're trying to make live through social media and the way that you carry yourself in various communities, but you have a way that you actually are that's hidden from the real world. That disintegration is depressing. And again, I think all these superhero movies do a very good job of showing that the reason why the hero is so depressed is because they're living a lie. They're not able to be fully themselves. And so they're falling apart. And that is psychologically how reality works. If you are not integrated in who you are, if you have to be fake or hypocritical, or to put on a facade just to live in the real world, then you're not really you. And if you're not really you, then you're going to only have half a life. And that half life is going to be despairing. It will be necessarily despairing.
Is it true, though, that if you're sin, and maybe you're not even in a position that you, if you're not a believer in Jesus, maybe you don't acknowledge sin, but if your sin or the things that you believe are wrong are secret and you feel like you're not harming anyone else, isn't it okay?
Well, I mean, weirdly, yeah, if you are, you know, and again, in superhero movies, this is why the villains are happier than the hero. The villain is able to just be them. They're fully them all the time. There's no secrets and they're happier. So you can live a technically happier life being fully integrated in sin than you can be living a life of fake virtue. Absolutely. That's the tragic story of the hero. So if you want to be fully, and that's what the decision that I made, kind of like the Faustian bargain with the soul, you give up your soul for material benefit. That was the decision I made as a teenager, is like, I would rather have material pleasure in my sexuality than immaterial grief and sorrow and guilt, which came from me failing my standard. But that is, again, it's a Faustian bargain. It's sacrificing your soul for the moment. And it's not a good bet. It's not a good bet. Eventually, it's going to lead you to harm, for sure. The higher calling is to be integrated in righteousness, which means that you have aspirations towards God that you're trying to live into. But due to that fact, you're having to live honest about what you are. That's why the community of believers has always been built around sacrifice, right? So the community of believers of God have always been built around the temple, and the temple has a primary function of sacrificing. Well, what is a sacrificial system but a constant acknowledgement that we are not living up to the aspirations that we are seeking? In fact, in the church, that's what we're doing when we take communion. Like, why are we constantly commemorating and symbolizing the sacrifice of Jesus? It's because none of us are what we ought to be. None of us are unified to God in the way that we should be. And we're taking that as a solemn reminder of what we're not, but what God is making us. So it's both an acknowledgement of failure, but also a remembrance of forgiveness and grace. And we put those two things together, and that's what gives us joy in the midst of this turmoil. So throughout the scriptures, you see people who are tormented by the fact that they're not what they should be, but they're never in despair, right? They really do believe in the grace and forgiveness of God. So I think about the Apostle Paul, where at the end of his life, the book of 1 Timothy, he says, "This is a faithful saying and worthy of all acceptance, that Christ came for sinners, of whom I am the worst. Right. So he's grieved over that. I am the worst sinner. I'm failing in every aspect of what I should be as an apostle and as a follower of Christ. But he follows that statement up by saying, for this reason, I have been saved, that I might be a pattern of grace for all those who might believe in his name for salvation. So Paul's saying, yeah, I'm the worst sinner. But because I'm the worst sinner, I am a pattern of the power of God's grace and forgiveness for everyone who might look to God for their salvation and their godly benefit, right? So putting those two halves together is incredibly difficult, but that is the pathway to true joy and blessedness.
I love it. Pastor, when we come back, I'm going to ask you, we've talked a lot about men, really. I want to ask you about women and how they're different. We'll be back with Pastor Peter Martin right after these messages.
Listening to KLYT. Welcome back to ABQ Connect.
We're back on ABQ Connect with Pastor Peter Martin. He is the teaching pastor of Calvary Marana in Tucson, Arizona. Should I say in Tucson, or is it actually Marana, separate community?
So, you know, Tucson's kind of the catch-all term. It incorporates all the suburbs and various, you know, areas of Tucson. But yeah, Marana is the more technical term, yeah.
So where are we at? 115 today? Down where you're at?
Yep, 115 degrees.
How do you go outside, Pastor?
You know, you don't. You try to avoid the sun as much as you can. You know, you just kind of hovel indoors and maybe you go in the pool. Yeah, it's not too great.
You definitely have to learn how to live there. But boy, in the what we would call the winter months, it's really beautiful, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Oh yeah, Tucson really shines in the winter.
Yeah, I love it. Lots of what's recreating for you and your family?
Well, you know, we do like going up to the lakes. You know, we're luckily Tucson's not too far from a lot of very beautiful lakes. We just were up at Lake Pleasant last weekend, which is up in Phoenix, only a couple hours from our house. The pools are always great. We set up sprinkler systems for our kids, things like that. Just keep out of the heat.
Water will cool you down. So talk to us about women. How are women different, and how do you see their role in both relationships and in the church?
Yeah. So originally God creates man as a singularity, right? So Adam is formed as a singularity, and then God brings woman out of him, which means that there's something about the woman that reflects the nature of God, right? So man is made in the image of God, and then woman is brought out of man, which means that woman reflects a very particular part of God, and also woman completes man, right? So that's what sex is a symbol of, is that woman is brought back to man, and that we are given an ability in sex to become one flesh again, to actually reintegrate ourselves in the one flesh unity that God had created Adam to fill singularly, though he couldn't do it. And it's so powerful that it can create life, which is incredibly beautiful. So I think that the best way to look at this, because it's a bit of a broader question, is actually the facet, the function of the garden itself, So Adam has this role in the garden, which is really interesting. And it's to name the creation, right? To subdue it is the language that the Bible uses. Sub means to put something under you. And do means render in accordance to worth. So Adam is able to subdue the creation by naming it or giving it its appropriate title or definition. That's what Adam is doing. And people are like, well, if that's Adam's role, if that's his ability, what would Eve's role be? And it also seems to be an ability that's divided into two, because Adam names the creation prior to Eve being taken out of him. So he names Eve, but if you remember the story, he doesn't name her Eve until after the fall. He names her woman at first, simply because she's taken out of man. So what is it that Adam lost, in essence, that Eve has that complements Adam's role of naming the creation? Well, it seems to be that Eve can listen to the creation. So it kind of helps. It's a bit of a theory, but it kind of helps us understand, why is Eve talking to the snake? Well, it seems that she has an ability to listen to the creation, which is totally right. You know, like when you think about marriage, when you think about raising kids, is the easiest way to see this. Men are great at calling their children to something higher. And that's why men tend to be the disciplinarians within the home. They're really great at calling their children to something more than what they are. They're not very good at listening to what they are already, though. They're not very good at understanding what their kids are already, and to also have compassion and empathy and love and affection for what their children are innately. So if there's too much fatherly love in a home, kids might end up feeling inadequate. But if there's too much motherly love in the home, well, then you see that event play out with the snake. So Eve is attending. She's doing exactly what she's supposed to be doing. She is attending to the margins of the garden, right? Which is what the snake represents, right? He's something that's slithering on the ground. Serpents look very vulnerable because they don't have the ability to defend themselves. From a physical perspective, if you didn't know anything about snakes, they seem defenseless because they're essentially all neck. They don't have anything to ward off predators. She obviously doesn't know about the venom component of the snake, but she's attending to the margin. She's attending to the vulnerable, and she's listening to that part of the creation. But because she doesn't know, she needs to be complimented by Adam's assertiveness, by his strength. She's vulnerable to listening to the deception of the serpent, to listening to his lies, and trying to attend to something that should be ignored or rejected. So Adam fails in complimenting Eve, and Eve fails in seeking Adam to compliment what she's doing. So that's I think, the one of the easiest ways that we can put it. Women have an innate ability to listen to the marginal, to the dispossessed, to the vulnerable, to have compassion and empathy on those parts of reality, and to understand them in a way that men can't. Men are better at shaping the world towards their interests, and that means calling the creation up towards what it can be, which includes the home. So I'll give a simple example. So let's say a man who is oriented up, he's oriented at calling the creation what it could be. He has an opportunity for a career, and he's going after it, right? What he's probably going to miss is the margins, the areas of his life that are compromised by accepting that upward call. Maybe the financial security he has to sacrifice, maybe the financial difficulties that he's going to incur, maybe the social consequences of moving his family or the children and how they might be affected by that decision. Those are the things that the man might be blind to, but the woman is perfectly attenuated to. So the woman's able to see those things, to realize them, and to bring them to the attention of her partner. But what the woman might do is she might bring them to, because if she feels as though the husband is not looking to her needs or hearing about the margins, she might start defending herself. And the way that looks is actually attacking the vision and the leadership of her husband and denigrating him. So the couple that's supposed to work together might end up being pulled apart by a singular decision, which is, again, what we see happen in the garden. The woman reaches up for power, and then the man empathizes with Eve in her fallen state, which is a reversion of what God had intended. So I think any community is benefited by the complementary strengths of both men and women. in that dynamic.
And life change happens as a couple and in their individual lives by reading the Word of God?
Yeah. So we have our perspective, but our perspective is incomplete without correct, I guess you'd call it like correct submission or obedience to something higher than ourselves. So I have my intuition about how I see a given scenario, but that intuition is going to be flawed because I'm flawed. In order for me to have a correct submission to God, I need to first be obedient to Him and His Word. In order to do that, I have to know what's in it, right? Which means that I have to be meditating and studying it. And hopefully, therefore, when husbands and wives argue or fight, they should recognize that what they're actually doing is they're trying to move towards the center, that both of their perspectives is missing something that the other one has. But you only can do that if you believe that there is something that you're both submitted to, a mutual obedience that governs and directs your decisions towards a singular goal. Otherwise, it's just the man's vision competing against the woman's vision.
I have two more questions for you. The first one is, and I'm going to tell you both of them now. First of all, does anybody live free of sin? And then the second question is to ask you if you would take a minute to encourage women who might be living in an abusive relationship.
No one lives free of sin. That's unfortunately a part of our fallen state. Even in a sense, you could say that Christ wasn't free of sin in his earthly life. That doesn't mean he sinned. We know he was sinless, but he was tempted. It says in Hebrews 4 that he was tempted. That's part of living in a world that is in bondage to sin and death. And even the apostles are very clear that the Christian life is subject to temptation. So even if we're not indulging, we are subject to temptations of sin all the time. That's part of our fallen nature. So no, we're not free of sin. We are always living in relationship to the reality of sin. And our striving is against that, but it's ultimately towards God. Now, for a woman living in an abusive relationship, I would say that that's, again, that goes into a positive thing about women that is inverted, corrupted, and exploited by the wicked one. So Eve is exploited because she wants to attend to the margin. She wants to attend to the vulnerable. And so she's open to being abused and taken advantage of by the snake. And most predatory men do appear as serpents, meaning that they don't appear as lions or wolves or something like that. They appear as serpents, things that seem marginalized, things that seem vulnerable, but are actually predatory. So if you're talking about an abusive man, he's probably going to present himself as someone who has levels of vulnerability in his character and needs this woman. And, oh, you're the only one who understands me. And if you left me, I don't know what I would do. I might even commit suicide. Right. There are ways that predatory men take advantage of women, but they usually take advantage of that desire for women to attend to the margins, attend and have compassion for those who need them. That kind of codependency. So for a lot of women in struggling in those circumstances and situations, I think that the best thing that they can understand is, number one, it's not a loving thing for you to enable sinful behavior. So I think a lot of women, they're able to, this is the compassion that God has given them. They are able to love by sacrificing themselves, which is what a mother does. Right? A mother sacrifices her body to give birth to her children. A mother sacrifices her body to nourish her child. That's what mother love is. And so I think a lot of women are vulnerable to believing like, oh, this is loving because I'm sacrificing myself to help this vulnerable, misunderstood individual in my life, or this really strong, but also in private situations, he's vulnerable and gentle and all these things. And I need to be there for him because I'm the only one, right? I think that can be exploited and can even be perceived as love. And what I would say is like, no, there's nothing loving about enabling evil or wicked behavior, and abuse towards a human being, an image bearer of God, is one of the most evil things that someone could do. So you being that image bearer and you being in a position where you're being abused and allowing that to happen in some way, enabling that behavior, that's not only not loving, but it's incredibly unloving. And I think it needs to be almost pictured that way by a lot of women so that they can understand, like, me moving away from this person or fighting them or doing the really hard thing of standing up or even running away sometimes and getting help, that is actually the most loving thing I can do. I think what holds a lot of women in bondage in abusive relationships is the belief that what they're doing is loving, and that to abandon this person would be an act of selfishness, which is not true.
Yeah. Amazing. Pastor Peter Martin, he is the pastor of Calvary Marana, Tucson area in Arizona. You can go to Calvary Marana. That's M-A-R-A-N-A, M-A-R-A-N-A.com, CalvaryMarana.com. And you can look at his teachings and listen to what he has to say. Today's hour with you, Pastor Peter, has been absolutely amazing. You speak to us with a lot of wisdom and a lot of, we could call them sound bites, but I just call them pearls of wisdom. And I just really appreciate how succinctly you answer the questions. And I know it's encouraged a lot of our listeners today. So thank you. Appreciate you doing that.
Yeah, no problem, Jim. Always a pleasure talking to you.
Good talking to you, my friend. And that'll do it for questions today. And look forward to talking to you down the road. So appreciate you joining us.
ABQ Connect is a production of KLYT. The views expressed on ABQ Connect do not necessarily reflect the views of the staff or management of KLYT.